Joseph McGuire is out as Director of National Intelligence, and Richard Grenell is in.
Trump has made it extremely clear that the first and frankly only criteria that he places in terms of who he's going to pick for his senior national security appointments is loyalty to the president.
I'm Arun Venugopal, and today on The Takeaway for February 24th, we'll take a look at what President Trump's latest appointment means for the intelligence community and for U.S. national security. Also, today we'll continue our census check-in series and the importance of an accurate count for Texas.
Here in Texas, a 1% undercount is about $300 million lost every year for the next 10 years.
Plus, the Houston Astros sign-stealing drama is still in the headlines. We'll discuss that and the MLB's response.
In this case, the fact that none of the players have been punished along with the team, I think that's what's causing this to spread and grow and continue to be a story.
First up, the new DNI. The U.S. intelligence community is on edge as the Trump administration clears out anyone deemed disloyal to the president. Last week, President Donald Trump announced Richard Grenell, the U.S. ambassador to Germany, as the acting director of national intelligence. In this role, he works with 17 different federal agencies and organizations, like the CIA, Office of Naval Intelligence, and the Defense Intelligence Agency. Grenell is a Trump loyalist with no national intelligence experience, and he replaces Joseph McGuire, a longtime national security professional. The president forced out McGuire last week after learning intelligence officials briefed lawmakers on Russia's efforts to intervene in the upcoming election on Trump's behalf. McGuire also drew the ire of Trump back in the fall when he publicly defended the whistleblower at the center of the impeachment scandal.
I believe the whistleblower is operating in good faith.
Well, then they couldn't
be. The law.
They couldn't be in good faith if they were acting as a political hack, could they?
Mr. Chairman, my job is to support and lead the entire intelligence community. That individual works for me. Therefore, it is my job to make sure that I support and defend that person.
As acting director, Grenell will serve in this role until March 11th. That's when the president is expected to put forth his nominee for a permanent director, who will then need to be confirmed by the Senate. And although his tenure will be temporary, Grenell is already leaving his mark on the historically nonpartisan intelligence community by ousting Andrew Holman, the number two official in the office of the Director of National Intelligence, late last week. Grenell's appointment is raising concerns for many within the intelligence community as well as Democratic lawmakers. The staffing shakeup is just the latest point of tension between the Trump administration and the intelligence community, and also part of a wider purge taking place in Washington, D.C. following Trump's acquittal in the Senate. For more on this and what it means for U.S. national security, we're joined by Ned Price, Director of Policy and Communications at National Security Action and former spokesperson for the National Security Council. You also spent 11 years at the CIA. Ned, thanks for being here.
Good to be with you.
Also with us is Daniel Dresner, professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Daniel, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you, Arun.
Ned, I want to start with Joseph McGuire, who President Trump ousted from the role of acting director last week for basically doing his job, right?
Well, that's right. If you read and believe what has been printed in the New York Times and Washington Post, the stories allege that what sparked President Trump's ire was essentially, as you said, Joseph McGuire authorizing one of his senior officials to go to Congress to brief on the latest with regard to election security. But it's more than just doing his job, Arun. It's actually a legal requirement. For the past 40 years, the intelligence community has been required to keep Congress fully and currently informed of issues that are germane to its oversight. And frankly, as we learned in the whistleblower case and impeachment, there is nothing that is more integral to the issue of congressional oversight than the sanctity and security of our elections. And what the New York Times reported last week is that President Trump grew so angry that the senior DNI official, the official responsible for the security of our elections, actually briefed Congress on what she was legally required to do and therefore essentially terminated Joseph McGuire from his post weeks before he was required to step down.
Now, Ned, just to take a quick step back, what exactly does the Director of National Intelligence and its office do?
Well, there's really no mold for the director of national intelligence because there have only been five individuals who have held this post in a Senate-confirmed capacity since the post was created by Congress in 2004. If you look at the legislation that creates the post, there are three primary charges that this individual shall carry forward. The first is to serve as the head of the intelligence community. As you mentioned in your introduction, there are 17 departments and agencies, including the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, that form part of this intelligence community enterprise. The second is to serve as the chief intelligence advisor to the president. And typically, what this has meant over the past nearly two decades, 15 or so years now, is that the DNI will play a key role briefing the president on what's in the PDB or the president's daily brief several times a week. This individual has tended to start national security policy meetings, the NSC meetings that meet in the White House Situation Room that the president attends. This individual, and they've all been men to date, this individual will provide an intelligence brief to sort of set the table for the policy discussion that is to follow. And three, the legislation charges this individual with overseeing the implementation of the strategic agenda of the operational capabilities and objectives of the intelligence community. Now, the five individuals, the five men who have held this post, have all served in this function in slightly different ways. I think if you talk to intelligence veterans, the model that people typically look to for how this role should be carried out is President Obama's second DNI, Jim Clapper. Jim Clapper avoided some of the pitfalls of getting too operationally involved in the decisions of the CIA and the other intelligence agencies under his purview, but played the role of a coordinator, of someone who steered the intelligence enterprise strategically at the macro level quite ably, quite effectively. And frankly, I think that is precisely what the legislation envisioned.
Daniel, let's talk a little about Richard Grenell, the new acting director. He has been described as a Trump loyalist, but it wasn't always that way, was it?
No, it wasn't. Apparently, during the 2016 presidential campaign, Grenell tweeted a number of times about how Trump was basically unfit for office. I believe those tweets have now been scrubbed, which is understandable given the premium that Trump clearly places on loyalty in terms of when he hires his national security professionals.
So what do you make of the fact that someone who was a critic is now in this position?
Well, this is basically where this is the bed you have to lie in if you are a Republican that wants to serve in this administration. In some ways, the hiring of Grenell or the appointment of Grenell to the acting DNI spot is consistent with a larger pattern in which Trump has made it extremely clear that the first and frankly only criteria that he places in terms of who he's going to pick for his senior national security appointments is loyalty to the president. You know, there was a story that came out, I believe, in the Times over the weekend that says that Robert O'Brien, who's Trump's fourth national security advisor, apparently opens some of the National Security Council meetings by essentially distributing printouts of Trump's tweets, in which that is supposed to be the way in which they're going to implement policy. They basically take his tweets and try to reverse engineer them. You can argue to some extent Grenell is simply an extension of the way that O'Brien is running the NSC, except now within the intelligence community. Grenell is also known sort of as a gadfly on Twitter. When he was U.S. ambassador to Germany, and he still is U.S. ambassador to Germany, actually, he was known primarily for engaging the media, particularly Fox News. He was generally, according to reports, basically isolated within Germany itself.
Now, as we mentioned, he has no national intelligence experience. Does this suggest that the president couldn't find an appropriate loyalist from within the ranks of the intelligence community?
I think that's a safe assumption. Or the other way to think about it is that essentially, think of it as a Venn diagram, which is you want to find simultaneously someone who is considered has sufficient background and experience to actually competently run DNI and someone who is loyal to Donald Trump. And the intersection of those two circles is either narrow or non-existent. You know, there's been reports that I think Pete Hoekstra might be the person that Trump puts forward. You could sort of make a case that Hoekstra might be qualified. He was a former member of Congress, served on the Intelligence Committee, I believe. But in some ways, what's telling is that the whoever Trump announces as the permanent appointment might not even matter necessarily, because at least for this year, because by once he announces that appointment and is puts it forward to Congress, it reboots the amount of time that Grinnell can serve as acting DNI. It gives him another 6 months, basically. And so the interesting question is going to be, will Trump ever be able to pick someone that actually gets past Senate confirmation? There's no way Grinnell would. It's telling the degree to which the Republicans, I believe outside of Roy Blunt, as senator, have said absolutely nothing in favor of Grinnell as the appointment. And so the question becomes, will Trump simply sort of exploit this loophole in the Vacancies Act, where what he does is put forward a name that has to be dealt with in terms of Senate confirmation? The Senate won't confirm him, but it allows Grinnell to actually retain the acting position.
Ned, let's look at one of Grinnell's first moves, the hiring of Kash Patel as a top advisor. What, if anything, does this tell us?
Well, I think it tells us that he's going to run the intelligence community in a way that's profoundly different from that of his predecessors. One of the strengths of the intelligence community since really its inception in the late 1940s in the post-World War II era was its apolitical identity. There are very few political appointees within the hierarchy of U.S. intelligence, and that is for a very good reason. There should be a firm dividing line, a red line, between intelligence and policy. Intelligence, in the best of times, is supposed to inform policy. Policy is never supposed to color or contour what the U.S. intelligence community presents as fact, as objective truth or analysis. I think what Rick Grinnell is trying to do, at least what he's signaling, is that he is installing individuals who don't have much experience in intelligence, but what they do have, they make up for in spades in ideology. These are ideologues, people who have been at the side of people like Devin Nunes, the vice chair of the House Intelligence Committee, a staunch Trump ally, someone who has served at the National Security Council with President Trump. And I think this is emblematic of precisely why President Trump selected Rick Grinnell for this acting position. He didn't want Rick Grinnell to serve as a DNI, at least not as the 2004 legislation envisions. He wants someone and really a team there who will, above all, protect and prize President Trump's personal interests, even when those clash with the national interest. I think the analogy that I think is useful and instructive here, I think President Trump wants a Bill Barr for the intelligence community, someone who will be there atop this enterprise to do his bidding, even when his bidding isn't necessarily consistent with the national business.
So, Daniel, in that respect, this is just an interim position, but you think it can fundamentally reshape the intelligence infrastructure here?
Oh, sure. I mean, to back up what Ned said, in some ways, to be fair, all presidents should want to trust their intelligence advisors. You know, if you're the president, you want to have people that you can trust in these kinds of positions. And this has been an argument that the Trump loyalists have been making. But as Ned said, the issue is that if you're an intelligence professional, you are also obligated to tell the president what the intelligence actually shows, regardless of whether or not that intelligence actually conflicts with something that Donald Trump has said in a tweet. And we've known from the past 3 years that Donald Trump does not like it when he gets intelligence briefings that contradict his core beliefs. Now, ordinarily, you would want the beliefs to change. You would want a president to update their priors and understand, oh, I guess I was wrong about this. Maybe there's some new information. But in essence, Trump, by hiring Grinnell, has actually signaled something rather different to the intelligence community. It's a warning shot across the bow of all the professionals, which is, do not, under any circumstances whatsoever, pass forward information that contradicts the president of the United States, regardless of whether factually that's correct or not.
Daniel Dresner is professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and Ned Price is the director of policy and communications at National Security Action and a former spokesperson for the National Security Council. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With the nationwide rollout of the census just a few weeks away, we're checking in on how community leaders across the country are working to prevent undercounts in their states. Last week, we looked at Oklahoma, a state that's allocated no funding to census outreach efforts. Today, we zero in on Texas, where lawmakers also opted not to fund census outreach. So, like in Oklahoma, nonprofit leaders are having to step in to try to ensure an accurate count. One piece of that means building trust in Latino communities.
In a state as big as ours, it's really critical that we make sure that we say that we're here, right? Because we're also a state that deals with a lot of immigration enforcement, border issues, And we're a site of a lot of that animosity and tension. And so it becomes even more highlighted in this work.
That's Genesis Sanchez, who's helping oversee census efforts in Texas for the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials.
Latinos here in the state are expected to become the largest population group by 2022. In addition to that, nearly half of Texans who are under the age of 18 are Latino. And so we know that our community gets undercounted, and our goal is really to help empower and to make sure that they recognize their power is in getting counted.
In June of last year, the Supreme Court ruled that the Trump administration could not include a question asking about citizenship status on the census form. But Genesis told me that informing Texans of the change has been a really big hurdle.
A lot of that damage was done, and it wasn't just for us as Latinos, but also for the state as a whole. So we did research on this, and we saw that Latinos in particular, a significant percentage of them still thought there was a citizenship question on the form. And based on prior research by the Bureau and by ourselves, we also saw that when people saw a citizenship question, they just would not respond to the form. And so we're looking at millions of dollars lost in resources as well as political representation. But it's not just a Latino issue. It's an issue for a lot of immigrant groups. But we're also seeing a lot of increase in distrust in the government. And so even people who you wouldn't expect to have any fears about completing the census are also kind of hesitant and will highlight that, you know, if they're scared, then somebody who might be out of status or who is a part of a mixed status family is also more likely to be scared as well.
So tell me more, beyond Latinos in Texas, what other groups are you seeing who are really kind of scared off by the census count?
So in Texas, about 25% of our population is considered hard to count. So we're looking at folks who, yes, are Latino, but also Black, Indigenous, people who rent, people who are low income. It really depends on the situation. What we're also seeing here is that there's a lot of mobilization from communities like the Arab American communities, Muslim American communities, because they're also very much growing. We're looking at places like in Austin where there's a growing Asian American population. And they also have a lot of hesitancy around the census because they don't want to share their information, right? We've already seen a hypervigilance of these communities as well. And so when it comes to sharing their information, there's also a lot of need to reach out to these community groups and let them know that their information is safe and secure.
Now, are these fears located more in urban centers like Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, or is this something that's more a rural problem?
It's everywhere, to be honest. So yes, absolutely in the big metropolitan areas that you've named, but we've been in some rural areas as well, and you see people who, you know, if you live really far apart from your neighbor, if someone comes to the door, you're going to be really hesitant to open that door because maybe somebody doesn't visit you that often. And so part of the issue with different areas is kind of the lack of access and the lack of infrastructure for something like a complete count committee or for people to get involved simply because the state is really, really big.
So what's the message that seems to resonate the most with people in Texas? Is it every person counts, or is it that if you don't fill out the census form, you'll lose out on crucial funding that help with services that you depend on?
I think that's what makes the work a little challenging, is that depending on who you are and who you're working with, you kind of have to make the messaging relatable. For a school district, it might make a lot of sense to talk about things like Title I grants, CHIP, Medicaid, WIC, free and reduced lunch as programs that are guided by census data. On the other hand, that might not be something that's relatable to someone who's older, who already has kids in college. So they may be thinking about things like roads, infrastructure, political representation. And so we have to tailor the message. But what we do know based on research is that what we want to emphasize with people is that their information is safe and secure, and also that the census data drives a lot of decision-making and allocation of resources based on the thing that they're interested in.
How much does Texas stand to lose from an undercount?
So here in Texas, a 1% undercount is about $300 million lost every year for the next 10 years. And in a place like Texas, that means that we're really pushing up against current infrastructure. We're growing really quickly. We're grabbing a lot of people from California, but also from places like New York. And so that growth has to be reflected in census numbers so we can make sure that we get the adequate infrastructure that we need to grow at a healthy pace.
But it's not just infrastructure, right, or services. We're also talking about congressional representation.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the 2020 census, we have the chance to gain 2 to 3 congressional seats, which in Texas is a big deal.
Among the people who are not interested in an accurate census count, is it clear whether those additional congressional seats would be more in Democratic areas or in Republican areas?
I'm not sure about that, but what I will say is that the census is not a political issue. It has become very politicized in recent times because of things like the citizenship question and because a lot of the states didn't allocate funding or resources to census outreach. And ideally, you know, we would want people to participate and to advocate for the census regardless of their party affiliation. And we have seen that in the state. So even though we haven't had the state legislature make a decision or put forward money on in terms of census outreach, we have seen, you know, people across the aisle say, hey, we need to collaborate and come together to the table and ensure that the community gets counted. So people recognize that, right? Especially in a place like Texas where big business is a big deal. You do see a lot of businesses, for example, saying, well, I stand to lose a lot of money if both my employees and my clients don't get counted, because then I can't build more businesses out. I can't grow and expand if I don't have that data to prove it. They may have different political leanings, but they're in the fight as well.
Genesis Sanchez is the Texas Regional Census Campaign Manager for Naleo Educational Fund. Thanks so much, Genesis.
Thank you.
And listeners, we want to hear from you as the full census rollout approaches. Are you planning to fill out the 2020 census? And what questions do you have about the process? Our number here is 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. In the United States, domestic violence incidents involving guns are on the rise. And women are especially vulnerable. When a domestic abuser has access to a firearm, it's 5 times more likely that the victim will be killed. According to the Giffords Law Center, nearly 1 million women alive today report being shot or shot at by an intimate partner. And 4.5 million women say that an intimate partner has threatened them with a gun. And while the terms domestic violence or intimate partner violence can encompass all kinds of abuse, the fact remains that women are at the highest risk of being harmed or killed by a firearm, by a male spouse or partner, according to Every Town for Gun Safety Support Fund. All this week on The Takeaway, we're going to explore the link between domestic violence and firearms. We'll hear from a survivor whose husband nearly ended her life when he shot her 4 times, and what she wants people to know about her experience. We'll also learn about the legal landscape of self-defense when abused women turn guns on their partners, fearing for their lives. And we'll look at states taking creative new approaches to taking firearms away from those who might use them to kill a partner. But first, to understand what we know about this problem, I spoke to Julia Weber, Implementation Director at the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. I asked her why we've seen this spike in the number of women being murdered by a partner who has a firearm.
Part of it is we are studying the connection between firearms and domestic violence, hopefully more effectively, documenting it and developing a better understanding of the connection. So that's significant. We also know that there's been an increase in gun ownership in the United States. And just last year, we have a study that indicates that higher rates of gun ownership are associated with higher rates of homicide in domestic violence situations. So there's possibly a connection there. You know, it's a difficult area to study, but it is absolutely of concern, and hopefully we're doing a better job documenting the problem.
It sounds like this involves, on one hand, simply more guns in the population, but also more people reporting this kind of violence.
More people reporting and just a better job documenting it. I mean, part of the issue is when somebody is shot or killed, how is that documented? How do we collect that data? How do we report it out and so forth? So, you know, there are still some questions, for example, around suicide and firearms and how often we can really understand that someone is taking their own life. As opposed to perhaps, you know, dealing with a domestic violence situation or, you know, in response to ongoing emotional abuse, for example. So it might get listed as a suicide, but if you did some further inquiry, we could discover that it was connected to domestic violence, for example. So, you know, we have to, it's a very isolating experience, domestic violence is. Intimate partner violence often goes unreported. And so just improving how we collect the data, how we report it out is critical to the discussion as well.
So what does the data tell us about how often women are killed by intimate partners using guns?
Well, the statistics indicate that every year, 600 American women are shot to death by intimate partners. So that's significant. And in fact, we know that of all women shot to death by others in the U.S., half were shot by their intimate partners. We also know that the death toll extends to mass shootings. In about 54% of mass shootings, which are defined as a situation where four or more people were killed, the shooter killed an intimate partner. So when we learn about other types of gun violence, we have to also be considering what the relationship might have been between the shooter and at least one or more of the people killed. A lot of people don't know that most mass shootings happen entirely within a home under that definition. So family violence, intimate partner violence, firearm violence, mass shootings, all very tightly connected.
Are states that have lax gun laws more prone to higher rates of gun-related domestic violence?
There does seem to be an indication that having tighter gun laws are correlated with reduced homicide rates associated with domestic violence. So we know that background checks, for example, are very good at stopping abusers from getting guns. Our statistics indicate that 1 in 9 background check denials are connected to domestic abuse. And over 300,000 domestic abusers have been blocked from buying guns by the federal background check system since its inception. We know that in states that do a better job prohibiting domestic abusers from having access to firearms, there's a decrease in injury and lethality. You know, one of the interesting statistics to me is that nearly 1 million women alive today report being shot or shot at by an intimate partner.
Wow.
So part of the issue, it's not just a lethal outcome we're concerned about. We also know there are people living today with injuries, threats associated with intimate partner violence and firearms. So the more we can do to address that connection between firearms and domestic violence, I think the better off families will be.
Policy plays a pretty significant role in curbing domestic violence homicide, but are the new red flag laws showing any positive results?
So red flag laws, as they're often called, or extreme risk protection orders, ERPOs for short. In California, they're called gun violence restraining orders, are the newest civil restraining order approach to trying to reduce the harm associated with firearms when someone is going through a crisis or maybe a danger to themselves or to others. And there is some research suggesting that ERPOs do a lot to reduce the risk associated with firearms violence when someone is going through a situation like that, to temporarily remove guns for safekeeping, to protect that individual and to protect others.
So, Julia, where do things stand right now?
I think the increased awareness of the connection between firearms and domestic violence is critical so that we can inform victims and survivors of the risk. They may be very intimately familiar with what they're experiencing, the relationship, but knowing that the presence of firearms increases the risk for themselves, for their children, for the community at large, that's an important piece of information for them. It's an important piece of information for those of us in the public health world and in the legal community to do the right screening, ask the right questions, provide appropriate referrals and support so that we can more proactively intervene and prevent lethal outcomes or injury for family members and for all of us.
Julia Weber is the implementation director at the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Thanks so much, Julia.
Thank you very much.
If you or someone you know is affected by intimate partner violence and needs help, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE for support in English or Spanish. That's 1-800-799-7233. More in our series on guns and domestic violence tomorrow. It's The Takeaway. There's no crying in baseball, but there is cheating. Major League Baseball is experiencing one of its biggest cheating scandals in recent years. The Houston Astros were found to have been using technology to read signals right before a pitch to give their hitters an advantage. Now, listen closely here. This is from a game in September of 2017. An Astros hitter is getting ready to play ball. Did you hear those two bangs? It was faint, but that was the sound of someone in the Astros dugout banging twice on a trash can. And that banging is at the very heart of the controversy. The Astros used cameras to find out what the catchers were signaling and then hit the trash can to tell the hitters what kind of a pitch to expect. And that year, 2017, the Astros won the World Series. But in late 2019, a former Astros player revealed this cheating scheme, leading to an investigation by the MLB. As a result of the probe, the team owner fired the Astros manager and the general manager. The team was fined $5 million. And Houston was barred from first and second round draft picks for 2020 and 2021. However, the Astros kept their World Series trophy, and all the players involved got to keep their jobs. The use of new technology for cheating is a whole new ballgame, and it may lead to further investigations and mistrust of Major League Baseball. I'm joined now by two guests to help us break this all down. Dave Zirin is the sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, great to have you with us.
Oh, it's great to be back.
And Bradford William Davis is a sports columnist covering Major League Baseball for the New York Daily News. Bradford, great to have you on The Takeaway.
Yeah, good to be here.
All right, so gentlemen, I grew up in Houston in the era of Nolan Ryan and Mike Scott and Billy Hatcher, and like it was a very painful childhood, okay, because we never, ever won. We never went all the way. But I remember even as a perpetually disappointed kid that the epitome of sports scandals was the Chicago Black Sox, meaning the 1919 Chicago White Sox team who threw the World Series. And even as a kid, I knew that, right? They're like, oh, that was like the worst of the worst. Where do the Astros compare? How do the Astros compare to that team in sheer notoriety? Start with you, Bradford.
Yeah, it's getting bad. I think, Shoeless Joe and his crew, at least they didn't have social media amplifying it. We weren't able to share clips of, evidence of them betting on baseball or whatnot. So this is like it's metastasizing because we can see and hear and go back and look at games and find out exactly when and why they cheated or how they cheated.
Yeah. I mean, Dave, this is social media age, though. This is a pretty old school kind of, I mean, it's like we've got trash can bangs and stuff like that. It's very like back to the roots, isn't it, here?
Yeah, but also electronic buzzers, which I think is one of the things that's freaking people out, the idea of technology taking the cheating to a whole nother level. And I'll tell you the big difference between this and the 1919 Black Sox is that eight members of that team were banned from the game, banned from the sport for life, the infamous eight men out led by Joe Jackson. In this case, the fact that none of the players have been punished along with the team, I think that's what's causing this to spread and grow and continue to be a story. That's what's feeding the idea from other players that there should be brushback pitches and retribution on the field, feeding the idea from fans that somehow, and this is horrific, but threats leveled against players over social media is somehow acceptable. So of course the fault goes with those fans and those players saying they're going to hurt the Astros, but it also goes down to the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred, for not issuing the kind of punishment that makes people feel like justice was done.
Bradford, why does it matter that there is a secret communication between the catcher and the pitcher?
Well, I mean, the element of surprise is like a foundational part of getting guys out as a pitcher. You know, you want to be able to fool them about whether a fastball, curveball, or whatnot's coming. When you don't have that element of surprise and you have no recourse because all of it's happening, you know, electronically, there's no way to like really detect it really, unless I guess someone bangs a trash can in your direction. But, you know, if you don't have that, you know, that just kind of completely breaks down your ability to outsmart, you know, your opponents. Yeah, that really matters. And whether you have a fastball coming, you know, that's about to get grooved, or a curveball well off the plate. If you know that curveball is not going to be a strike, it's going to be a ball, then you just lay off of it and you wait for your pitch. Statistically speaking, the Astros improved significantly the moment they started using the trash can version of their sign stealing scheme.
I'm going to play a clip for you. This is Mike Trout from the LA Angels.
If you know what's coming, it's going to definitely help you. I think that's, you know, it's tough. You're taking the trophy away, taking the rings away. I think they should definitely do something. I don't know what, but to cheat like that and not get anything, it's sad to see for sure.
Dave, what do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, Mike Trout usually doesn't say anything beyond, well, let's play one game at a time. Good Lord, right. Let's play one game at a time. So to have Mike Trout say this, I mean, people have to understand what a neutron bomb that is in the context of the culture of Major League Baseball. And I think anything short of taking the rings and the commissioner's trophy, what Rob Manfred called, a hunk of metal, which also upset Major League players, I think that's the sort of thing that players and fans are asking for. Like, they want something that says, this is not going to be okay. There's a line in the sand that you crossed. Whether or not that's going to happen is another question.
And Dave, I mean, this is coming after years and years of various other scandals, steroid scandals and the likes. Are people jaded, or do you think they were genuinely outraged by this?
No, I mean, according to friends of mine who work at the Washington Post, for example, the amount of letters and emails they've gotten about this exceeds anything they've seen in years. I actually don't think people are jaded about this. People were jaded about steroids and PEDs because there was this perception that everyone was doing it. Whether that's true or not, there was this idea that somehow there was this chemical level playing field at work. This is about the Astros in particular, one team robbing a lot of other teams of their 2017 dreams. And that's why you get players like Aaron Judge of the Yankees, who is not somebody who we would describe as outspoken, saying things like, you cheated and you didn't earn it. I mean, in the staid world of baseball, that's like Patrick Henry speaking right there.
So how do you account for the fact that the league has gone relatively easy on the players?
A miscalculation, because Rob Manfred is very, very poor at his job.
What do you think, Bradford?
I mean, you know, one thing to understand is that baseball deserves zero sort of benefit of doubt on this. Back when they instituted instant replay, which was used very specifically by the Astros and the Red Sox, who are at least undergoing a probe right now to understand the extent of their sign-stealing operation. You know, one of the concerns back then in 2014 was, will the live game feed be used to zoom in on the catcher's mitt, see what they're going to call for, and then thus, you know, be relayed for sign-stealing? You know, there was some awareness of this. There were teams who have brought up concerns about sign-stealing. The Oakland A's, went out officially, behind the scenes to tell Major League Baseball, we're concerned about this. But even though there were apparently some small check-ins done, there was no investigation that brought anything to the light. So whether that was a lack of diligence or incompetence or both, or just trying to avoid the situation entirely, Major League Baseball had opportunities to really hone in on this well before 2017, before the World Series got arguably compromised, and they didn't really do the job. So, I mean, I completely understand why, Rob Manfred is getting the heat that he has, because for many years, until a journalist, Evan Drellich from The Athletic, actually went out and said, yeah, this is happening, and I got some on the record, confirmation of it, it seemed like it was just a growing issue that wasn't being addressed properly by the league.
On that note, we got to wrap up. Bradford William Davis is a sports columnist covering Major League Baseball for the New York Daily News. Bradford, thanks for being here.
Of course.
And Dave Zirin is a sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening and talking with us today. If you ever want to share your insight with us, call and leave us a message at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm Arun Vanigopal, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.